Well, welcome everybody. This evening we have our fifth class on Deuteronomy. I chose a background slide from the Sinai Peninsula. As you know, Deuteronomy, of course, is at the end of Moses' life. They're at the foot of Mount Nebo. They're in the plains of Moab. They're right next to the Jordan River. They're getting ready to cross over and take the promised land. But he is going back over the history. He is reminding them, repeating what they should know. Now, those that at least were older among them would be familiar with, you know, the whole 40 years and would understand their own history quite well. But maybe for the sake of the younger ones and for the sake of repetition, for their terrible ability to forget so quickly, he is now recounting much of their adventures in a region that is like this so much of the time. A little bit later, you'll be seeing a series. I think I've got three or four artist illustrations by a man you've seen before, David Roberts, great explorer, adventurer, who back in the 1800s had taken some trips to Israel and to the Sinai Peninsula. So I've got some of his illustrations also, scenes that he beheld while he was in the Sinai Peninsula. But all of the background slides you'll see tonight, you know, have to do with the Sinai, even though the event, the book, is being written down there in the plains of Moab. We'd like to say that I very much appreciate Ted's work last week, filled in for me while I was up at Salem. The Market Street congregation there has been very gracious to me, had me up there each summer now for their summer series for a number of years. So it was good to see them. Got to see the Nevilles and ate a whole bunch of their ice cream afterwards. I must have abused their hospitality, as I didn't even leave the house till about a quarter to 11. I was having such a good time, full of that strawberry ice cream. So we had a good time there, and I got to see Jeff Putterbaugh as well. He's one of the elders at Market Street there, you know, so he came over and had a lively conversation there. But, you know, goodwill and blessings from them as I relay from you to them. And thanks to Ted for two things, though. Excellent class. He covered chapters 7 and 8 and the first six verses of chapter 9. But most especially, I really appreciate the 10 minutes that he said that I would have. You would all understand. And you didn't think I listened to those classes, did you? So I'm claiming my 10 tonight. We'll just go and run along, I suppose. But he did. He did a fine job. Always does. I know you know that. And so I appreciate the depth of our bench, as they sometimes say, you know, men that can be so effective, of course. And so thanks for that. We're going to start tonight with chapter 7, though, because where Ted ended up at verses 5 and 6, that ties into something back in the beginning of chapter 7. That I wanted to just touch on now as we then we'll move on into the succeeding verses from chapter 9. So if you go back to chapter 7 and look at verses 6 through 10. Chapter 7, 6. You are a holy people to Yahweh your God. Yahweh your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Yahweh did not set his love on you nor choose you because you were more in number than any of the peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But because Yahweh loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers, Yahweh brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that Yahweh your God, he is God, the faithful God who keeps his covenant and his loving kindness to a thousandth generation with those who love him and keep his commandments, but repays those who hate him to their faces. To destroy them, he will not delay with him who hates him. He will repay him to his face. So we have two things there. This idea first, you know, that don't think too highly of yourselves. You weren't chosen because you're more numerous. And then also, God's faithfulness. I'll keep my covenant. You may not, and we'll see more of that, of course, again this evening, but I certainly will. Now, in chapter 9, as we came to the end of Ted's class last week, if you look at verse 4 in chapter 9, we have the same idea. Do not say in your heart, when Yahweh your God has driven them out before you, because of my righteousness, the Lord your, Yahweh brought me in to possess this land. It is because of the wickedness of these nations that Yahweh is dispossessing them before you. It wasn't anything to do with you guys, you Jews. You didn't stand out in numbers. You didn't stand out in righteousness. You can't ever claim that the great and only living true God picked you because of you. He picked you for His own purposes. He picks you now, you, these particular people who are about to enter into their promised land, because of His faithfulness to His covenant, because of the promises He had made to their fathers, because of promises that were first issued to whom and in what chapter? What is the great chapter of Moses' books where we get the promise to Abraham? What chapter is that? Genesis 12. That's pretty early in the history of humankind. That's pretty early in biblical history. God is working His plan, telling them about their plan. He's revealing promises to Abraham that are going to, you know, not be fulfilled for over 400 years. And so Abraham's in 1900s, Moses is 1500s, coming down to 1400s. Apparently there's argumentation about the dates. But, you know, there's 400 or 500 years where this promise had been made to Abraham. When the promise was made to Abraham, what a great giant nation he was. Well, was it because they were a numerous people? No, there was just him and Sarah. He didn't have any kids even. How big a nation is that? Okay, but I will. I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you. People that bless you will be blessed. Those that curse you will be cursed. And in you shall all the peoples of the earth be blessed, in your seed. And you'll get a land, of course, as well. So never think that God picks the Jews, He wants them to know, because of anything that they particularly have done. So again, you can see Sinai there, and supposedly in 1839, when David Roberts drew this, now he had brought his troop up to what they deemed to be the foot of Mount Sinai. Don't know for sure, but it is actually a pretty probable place, I suppose, because right at its foot there's this giant flat valley where you could easily park all the people that are the Jews for all the time that they're going to be at the foot of that mountain. Now, let's just start with chapter 9, verse 6, and we'll roll on, where God has a whole section that continues this idea. I'm not going to break my covenant. I made the covenant not because of you, but because of my sovereign decisions here. And if you won't keep it, part of the covenant is the punishments that I'll visit upon you if you don't. So let's just start reading. It is, as you can see, a very lengthy section there, but in chapter 9 and beginning in verse 6. Again, know then, it is not because of your righteousness that Yahweh your God is giving you this good land to possess, for you are a stubborn people. Remember, do not forget how you provoked Yahweh your God to wrath in the wilderness from the day that you left the land of Egypt until you arrived at this place. You've been rebellious against Yahweh. Even at Horeb, you provoked Yahweh to wrath. And Yahweh was so angry with you, He would have destroyed you. When I went up to the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant which the Lord had made with you, then I remained on the mountain 40 days and nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water. Now, let's pause here just long enough that you can grab your pencil and write in the margins of your Bible some references there. And always look at a side column or center column, you know, to see if you have these already. But what he's talking about there is in Exodus 34 and verse 28, and then again in Deuteronomy chapter 9, and verse 18. So we'll be coming up on it in just a minute. But you might want to jot those down. Got our 40 days and 40 nights here. In a moment, some of you, of course, I know, are reading ahead. We're going to find out kind of a surprising thing about 40 days and 40 nights. So then, in verse 10, Yahweh gave me two tablets of stone written by the finger of God. And on them were all the words which Yahweh had spoken with you at the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly. And it came about at the end of 40 days and nights that Yahweh gave me the two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Then Yahweh said to me, "Arise, go down from here quickly, for your people whom you brought out of Egypt have acted corruptly. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made a molten image for themselves." Yahweh spoke further to me, saying, "I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stubborn people." Now, brethren, already in just these few verses, three times he said that. The end of verse 6, "You're a stubborn people." Middle to the end of verse 7, "From the day you left the land of Egypt till you arrived at this place, you've been rebellious." Here comes verse 13. Yahweh says, "I've seen this people, and indeed it is stubborn. Let me alone." Continuing in verse 14, God says, "That I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven. I'll make you a nation mightier and greater than they." So I turned and came down from the mountain while the mountain was burning with fire, and the two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands. I saw that you had indeed sinned against Yahweh your God. You had made for yourselves a molten calf. You had turned aside quickly from the way which the Lord had commanded you. And I took hold of the two tablets and threw them from my hands and smashed them before your eyes. And I fell down before Yahweh as at the first 40 days and nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all your sin which you committed in doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure with which Yahweh was wrathful against you in order to destroy you. But Yahweh listened to me that time also. And Yahweh was angry enough with Aaron to destroy him. So I also prayed for Aaron at the same time. And I took your sinful thing, the calf which you had made, and burnt it with fire and crushed it, grinding it very small until it was as fine as dust. And I threw its dust into the brook that came down from the mountain. Now here again, brethren, opportunity, you know, grab your pencil. What he's referring to here is a condensed version. But right in the margin, or find if you've got a reference, Exodus 32, verses 17 through 28. This is Exodus 32, verses 17 through 28. Where you will discover that Moses did indeed do the three things that are listed in this verse. Took the calf and burned it, ground it up, and threw its dust in the brook. But when you go to Exodus 32, 17 through 28, you'll find out he did two more things. You'll remember what they are. What were they? He made them drink it, and then what happened? And then Moses said, "All of you that are with me, come over here." And then what did he tell them to do? He told them to strap on their swords. And when they got them, what did he then tell them to do? "You take care of the ones that didn't." And how many died that day? 3,000. So in Exodus 32, 17 through 28, Moses doesn't even mention the fact that on that day, and by their own brother's hands, fellow Jews, swords were taken up and 3,000 were slain because of the horror of what had happened right there. Now, I know it's going to sound like, you know, this is just an endless record, and I apologize for that. Not everybody is in the Sunday morning class. It's only totally coincidental. We're doing Deuteronomy, of course, with 24 as a figurehead, and in the marriage, divorce, remarriage thing. But I got to really looking at this chapter in preparation this week and thinking about what I've been saying, you know, so many times before in that other class. When the people are stubborn, that's a word that's been used here. When the people are rebellious, when the people turn their backs on God, when they turn away from God, when they harden their heart toward God, does God ever say, "Okay, I'll change my law and adjust it to your standard"? No, he does not do this. And so what he's portraying is a wrath to this people, which, you know, includes 3,000 dying by their own fellow Jews' hands. And now read just a little bit further in Deuteronomy 10, verses 22 through 24. Again, at Taberah, and at Massah, and at Kibbuth Hatavah, you provoked Yahweh to wrath. And when Yahweh sent you from Kadesh Barnea, saying, go up and possess the land which I have given you, then you rebelled against the command of Yahweh your God, and you neither believed him nor listened to his voice. You have been rebellious against Yahweh from the day I knew you. Well, how many times has the Lord then lowered his standards? How many times did he change the law? They'd always been rebellious. And the answer is never. So, I just want to read a few passages for you tonight out of 5.5 pages. I did some serious work here on this idea of hardening your heart, rebelling against God, being stubborn, you know, trying again to go back, find every single passage I could in the Old Testament. Does God ever do what I thought he did for so long in Deuteronomy 24? I thought he lowered the standard. People hardened their heart against him. God said, okay, then what used to be a sin, what used to be forbidden, I'll allow for the next 1,500 years. So I went back, I looked up every occasion in the Old Testament where you have these words stubborn and rebellion and all their various forms, because those were the two that were used here in Deuteronomy, which, of course, where we have chapter 24. There are more than 70. So it took 5.5 pages, pretty small font too, you know, to print these out. So I'm just going to pick the ones that have a consequence where God stipulates what he's going to do when people are stubborn and rebellious toward him. In Deuteronomy 29, we'll be coming up on this one at verses 18 through 20. He's got a man there, he says, who will boast and say, I have peace, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart. So people are going to claim, I have peace, even though I'm walking in the stubbornness of my heart. And what he continues to say then is, Yahweh shall never be willing to forgive him, but rather the anger of Yahweh and his jealousy will burn against that man, and every curse which is written in this book will rest on him, and Yahweh will blot out his name from under heaven. He doesn't say, okay, go ahead and divorce your wife. He says, no. Now in Judges chapter 2, they did not abandon their practices or their stubborn ways. I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died. In Nehemiah, they became disobedient and rebelled against you. Therefore, you delivered them into the hand of their oppressors. In Psalm 5, hold them guilty, O God. By their own devices let them fall. In the multitude of their transgressions, thrust them out. For they are rebellious to you. That's going to be done a number of times in Psalms, so I'll skip over the others. In Isaiah, they rebelled and grieved his Holy Spirit in chapter 63. Therefore, he turned himself to become their enemy. He fought against them. In Jeremiah, because they've forsaken my law, which I set before them, and have not obeyed my voice, nor walked according to it, but have walked after the stubbornness of their heart, as their fathers taught them. Therefore, says Yahweh, I will feed them, this people, with wormwood, and give them poisoned water to drink. I'll scatter them among the nations, and I'll send the sword after them until I've annihilated them. Jeremiah adds, you're each one walking according to the stubbornness of his own evil heart, without listening to me. So I'll hurl you out of this land into the land which you have not known. Lamentations has three of them. I'll read just the first. I've rebelled against his command. Hear now, all peoples, and behold my pain. My virgins, my young men, have gone into captivity. In Ezekiel, they have rejected my ordinances and have not walked in my statutes. Therefore, I am against you. I'll execute judgments among you in the sight of the nations. Again in Ezekiel, we've got about 5 or 6 in Ezekiel. Say now to the rebellious house, as I live, declares the Lord God, surely in the country of the king who put him on the throne, whose oath he despised and whose covenant he broke, in Babylon he shall die. Skip over, there may be 10 in Ezekiel. Here's Hosea. Woe to them, for they've strayed from me. Destruction is theirs, for they've rebelled against me. Put the
trumpet to your lips. Like an eagle, the enemy comes against the house of Yahweh because they've transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. Samaria will be held guilty, for she has rebelled against her God. They will fall by the sword. Their little ones will be dashed in pieces, and their pregnant women will be ripped open. Micah, what is the rebellion of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the open country, pour her stones down into the valley, and lay bare her foundations. I'll leave the other three from Micah uttered, and we'll just go to Zechariah 7, which is the last place you have in your Old Testament. They refused to pay attention and turned a stubborn shoulder and stopped their ears from hearing. They made their hearts like flint, so that they could not hear the law and the words which the Lord of hosts had sent by His Spirit through the former prophets, which surely include Abraham at least. Therefore, great wrath came from the Lord of hosts. So it's been on my mind, and it's been on yours. You've been thinking about it in the tie-in to Sunday morning. But brethren, this people, they weren't chosen because they were righteous. They were just some of the most stubborn and rebellious people ever. He says several times, from the day I called you, you have refused to serve me. And from the day He called them, they'll pay for it in each and every generation. And right now, as Moses is emphasizing it, what was the only thing that saved them? Moses, so angry himself, reflecting God's wrath, he throws the tablets down. They break. 3,000 people get killed. But God said, I'll just kill them all. We'll make a new nation out of you. It'll be even bigger and better. And what does Moses do? He spends 40 days and 40 nights begging God not to do it. And that's the second time. That's the second time. I think it's a very little known fact that when you go to the 40 days and 40 nights where Moses is fasting, that happened once, and then it happened again when he got down off the mountain. It took that measure of righteousness, that measure of love, in the face of such a measure of disgust and rage at the way that they were behaving, that he had broken tablets that God Himself had written on. But he spent 40 more days praying for those people. Did God change the law? No. He spared their lives because of the intercession of this good man Moses. And then what happens? Well, Moses goes right back up on the mount. So let's start with verse 25. So I fell down before the Lord the 40 days and nights, which I did, because Yahweh had said He would destroy you. And I prayed to the Lord and said, Oh Lord, Yahweh, do not destroy your people, even your inheritance, whom you've redeemed through your greatness, whom you brought out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Do not look at the stubbornness of this people or at their wickedness or their sin. Otherwise, the land from which you brought us may say, because Yahweh was not able to bring them into the land which He had promised them, and because He hated them, He's brought them out to slay them in the wilderness. Yet they are your people, even your inheritance, whom you brought out by your great power and your outstretched arm. At that time, Yahweh said to me, cut out for yourself two tablets of stone like the former ones. Come up to me on the mountain, make an ark of wood for yourself, and I'll write a different law on those tablets that lowers my standards because they've hardened their heart against me. No! I'll write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets which you shattered. You shall put them in the ark. So I made an ark of acacia wood, cut out two tablets of stone like the former ones, went up on the mountain with the two tablets in my hand, and he wrote on the tablets, like the former writing, the Ten Commandments which Yahweh had spoken to you on the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly, and Yahweh gave them to me. Then I turned and came down from the mountain, put the tables in the ark which I had made. There they are, as Yahweh commanded me. People, however rebellious they are, when God repents, His law stands. The people may be permitted to live on thanks to the intercession of a righteous man, but the law remains the same. So, carves the same one out, and here they are. Now, looking at the time, go ahead and turn your page if you need it in my Bible. You do. Look at verse 6 and grab your pencil again, because I think this is worthy of spending a little bit of extra time on, due to the fact that in Deuteronomy now, Moses is going to reference an event that occurs only elsewhere in Numbers. We haven't studied Numbers. We went from Leviticus to Deuteronomy, so we've missed this history. So first, right down next to verse 6, which says, "Now the sons of Israel set out from Beeroth Benajaakon to Mosera. There Aaron died, and there he was buried, and Eleazar his son, ministered as priest in his place." Right in the margin, Numbers chapter 20, verses 23 through 29. And, same book, Numbers, chapter 33, verses 37 through 39. So it's Numbers 20, 23 to 29, and Numbers 33, verses 37 to 39. So I just think this is so significant and helpful that we're going to go back and spend a moment on that, even though it's not in Deuteronomy. But, you know, this is Moses' brother. This is Moses' older brother. This is the first, you know, high priest. This is a big deal. And so he mentions it, but it is kind of a condensed version. Moses has been on the scene for Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. Now we're getting into Deuteronomy. He's telling the story again, but he still, you know, has to shorten it. So in Numbers chapter 20, let's read verses 23 through 29. "Yahweh spoke to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor, H-O-R, by the border of the land of Edom, saying, 'Aaron shall be gathered to his people. He shall not enter the land which I've given to the sons of Israel, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah.'" Now, this is endlessly fascinating to me. Why should Aaron die for what Moses did? Now, you know, Ezekiel 18, for instance, does God attribute one man's sin to somebody else? No. The Adamic sin, the original sin that is so often taught, you know, in our culture, does not exist in Scripture. It's contradicted in Ezekiel 18. And surely it's not happening here either. What I think we're learning here, brethren, is that in this great sin, where Moses is told he's not going to be able to go into that promised land because of it, was he utterly alone in that sin? And apparently not. Aaron somehow was involved in that one too. Now, Aaron's got his own problems with this calf. But Aaron, you know, he's involved at Meribah somehow. And we don't know how. But it's going to cost Aaron his life outside the promised land, and it'll do the same thing for Moses. Jimmy?
Wasn't he Moses' spokesperson, and so he was with him all the time?
He was, and that's a great point, you know, just to start off with, is that Aaron should have held him back then if he was going to do something wrong. But, you know, when the events are told so quickly, it's like we just read. There were five things that happened when they made the golden calf. How many did we read about? Well, only three. And what I would think is the biggest one is not that the calf got melted or ground up or thrown on water or drunk, but that 3,000 people died. That would seem to me the big deal, you know, gets left out of this particular account. So in this case, Aaron has responsibility, Jimmy, as you're saying, you know, somehow. Whatever it specifically was, we just don't know. So then it says in 25, "Take Aaron and his son Eleazar, bring them up to Mount Hor, not Sinai, and strip Aaron of his garments, put them on his son Eleazar. So Aaron will be gathered to his people and will die there." So Moses did just as Yahweh had commanded. They went up to Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. After Moses had stripped Aaron of his garments, put them on his son Eleazar, Aaron died there on the mountaintop. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain. And when all the congregation saw that Aaron had died, all the house of Israel wept for Aaron 30 days, which appears to be a standard period of time for mourning among the Jews, you know, for some great one among them. Now, come on over to chapter 33. There's only three verses there. Come on over to chapter 33 and a little bit more there. So 33, 37 through 39 now. They journeyed from Kadesh, camped at Mount Hor at the edge of the land of Edom. Then Aaron the priest went up to Mount Hor at the command of Yahweh and died there in the 40th year after the sons of Israel had come from the land of Egypt on the first day in the fifth month. And Aaron was 123 years old when he died on Mount Hor. How old will Moses be? 3 years younger. So his older brother is going to outlive him. His life will be 123. Moses will get 120. But they neither one will be permitted into that land. You sinned. And when you do, there are consequences. That's the way my covenant worked. We also learn here that it is the first day of the fifth month in the 40th year, and that they'll cross over the Jordan at exactly the end of 40 years. So this event's going to be taking place 7 months before the Jews will now then leave Mount Hor, cross through Edom, battle their way up on the eastern side of the Dead Sea and Jordan until they had conquered all that eastern land. And then they'll come back and they'll cross over and take on Jericho and make their central and frontal attack, you know, into the promised land itself. So the next 7 months are profoundly busy, very momentous, and battles that have to be fought and kings that are going to fall. But in all of that, you know, Aaron's not a party to that anymore. Can you imagine what this scene must have been like? It's my older brother by 3 years. He is my brother, and he is the first high priest. This is a very much a family thing now, this new religion that's being created here. And God tells me to take him up on that mountain right over there. And when I walk up to the top of that mountain, there's going to be a ceremony where I take the high priest's garments off of him. And then I put them on his son. Now here's Aaron standing there watching that happen. And he knows what's next. Aaron dies right there with his son and his brother. And the two of them will bury him on Mount Hor. Now, we do not know where Mount Hor is. Nobody knows where Mount Hor is. But here's David Roberts in 1839. The painting is entitled Travelers at the Tomb of Aaron on the Summit of Mount Hor. So they had climbed up in what local, you know, mythology and legend had said was Mount Hor. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. We're never going to know. Out there on the border of Edom, so we have a general idea where that is. And here in 1839, they're camping there. So David Roberts, you know, not in a fanciful manner, but trying to be a historian, you know, is recording as an artist what it is that he's looking at. So perhaps, you know, it was this very place, but at least it was somewhat like this. We have these three men go up and only two come back down. Moses knows and has already said in the earlier chapters of the book we've studied, is he going to cross the Jordan? No. 7 months later, what will happen? Moses, I want you to climb a mountain. He knows what's coming. So God has always been, you know, a God of revelation. A God who not only reveals what is right and what is wrong, but is a God who can foretell the future and does. It is, I believe, the single strongest, most powerful evidence there is that there is a God in heaven and that it is the God of the Bible. That prophecy is always and minutely, precisely fulfilled. Whether it's fulfilled in, you know, a few hours or days or months or years or centuries, God has spanned them all. And here is a most impressive thing for these Jews to understand. So as they're getting this second recount of the law, 7 months ago, maybe more like six, we've got a lot of Deuteronomy to go yet, pardon me. I mean, 6 months from now, you know, these people are going to be standing there, and he's recounting that, you know, we just lost Aaron. He was with us the whole 40 years. And I'm telling you, it's because you hardened your heart against your God. Don't do it. And if you won't, according to this law, which I'm now meticulously repeating for you, then life is really going to be good for you, if only you will. This will bring us then to chapter 10. We'll take up the reading in verses 7 through 11, 1. I rather think that I prefer to add that first verse, you know, to this little soliloquy right here. But it's what it is really is a great title for a sermon. What does Yahweh require? Amos is going to use essentially the exact same theme a long time later. What does Yahweh require? What does God want out of his people? Then you say, well, read the whole Bible, you know, and it's all there. And that's true. But there are several occasions where God will boil it down for us. He'll say, here is, you know, just the core. Here's what I'm asking out of you. So this next passage, if you want to mark it somehow, brethren, 10:7 through 11:1 is just beautiful. And it's not only just beautiful, but it's so insightful. There's so much wisdom in here. And it is this very emotional and passionate appeal from God. Do what I ask you to do. If so, your heart's desires, it will all be fulfilled. You're never going to fail. Your enemies will all fall. Your crops will grow. Your children will live long and prosper. Just everything you can imagine that's good in life will be yours. If you Jews will just do what I ask. Here's what I ask. Chapter 10, verse 7, down through 11:1. From there they set out to Gudgadah, and from Gudgadah to Jotbathah, a land of brooks of water. At that time, Yahweh set apart the tribe of Levi to carry the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh, to stand before Yahweh, to serve him, and to bless in his name until this day. Therefore, Levi does not have a portion or inheritance within his brothers. With his brothers. Yahweh is his inheritance, just as Yahweh your God spoke to him. I, moreover, stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights like the first time. And Yahweh listened to me that time also. Yahweh was not willing to destroy you. Then Yahweh said to me, arise, proceed on your journey ahead of the people, that they may go in and possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. And now, Israel, what does Yahweh your God require from you? But to fear Yahweh your God, to walk in all his ways, and love him, and serve Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Now, you'll recall, we've had occasion in the morning class on Sunday morning. We've done it several times here. Is the greatest, the foremost of all commandments that Jesus uttered in Matthew 22, is that the first time this idea appears in the pages of Scripture? No. Brethren, it's my very firm conviction, though for a long time I didn't think so, that the kind of person, the character, the virtue, the personality that the Old Testament was intended to produce and to create is exactly the same as what the New Testament teaches. They were not asked to be more than what we're asked to be. They're not allowed to be less. There are a core set of values that comprise God, who is love. These values are immutable. It means they can't be changed. God doesn't change. And God has always expected a certain set of things to be so, and they are inviolate. There was never a time when it was okay to murder because people didn't want to serve God. It was just never okay to murder. Not before Moses, not during Moses, not after. God requires a core set of values, and they are equally presented, Old Testament or New. So what does Yahweh require of you? In verse 12, this is Leviticus chapter 19, all over again. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and all your strength is another way that Jesus speaks of it over in Matthew 22. Read it again in verse 12. Now, Israel, what does Yahweh your God require from you? But to fear Yahweh your God, to walk in all his ways and love him, and serve Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and keep Yahweh's commandments and his statutes, which I'm commanding you today for your good. Let me stop there for just a second. Has God ever given us a command that was intended to harm or in some way do damage to us? Are not all of God's commands, as he says here at the end of verse 13, for your good? Well, sure they are. And often enough, you know, we kind of kick against the goads. You know, God's asking this and God's asking that, and why shouldn't I be allowed to do this and why shouldn't I be allowed to do that? Well, because you're not wise enough to understand that if you had your way, that's what would damage you. I, God, know better. My commandments are for your good. That's why I give them. So, in verse 14, behold, to Yahweh your God belong heaven and the highest heavens, the earth and all that is in it. Yet on your fathers did Yahweh set his affection to love them, and he chose their descendants after them, even you, above all peoples, as it is this day. Circumcise then, now brethren, look at this very closely. Circumcise your what? Heart. For many years I believed and taught the Old Testament does not legislate the heart. The Old Testament is a system of salvation by works only. It takes Jesus coming to give us the new law, and then God will address the heart. So, in the New Testament, you'll find out that you not only shall not kill, but you cannot hate your brother. Brethren, I just didn't have sense enough to go back and really dig and look. And lo and behold, you're not allowed to hate your brother back in the Old Testament either. He didn't bring the law up. You shall not commit adultery. You also shall not covet your neighbor's wife. In the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, Jesus didn't say, well, it used to be you only could not commit adultery, but it was okay to have lust. Now I'm going to legislate on the heart. And I believe that, and I taught that. God now says more will be required of you. I'm going to raise the standard back up to the way it was before Moses. And brother, no. It was always that way. What I'm suggesting here is we do these tie-ins, you know, as well. God has pretty well always loved and defended women. Felt highly about the marriage contract. And never did he look at the husbands and say, well, if you guys just want to trash your lives' wives and throw them off, go ahead. He does not do that. So every time here you see in this love that God is intending for your heart to be controlled and for your heart to become like his heart. The Old Testament legislated exactly the same things about what your heart was supposed to be and do as it does in the New. It wasn't new. It's all over the Old Testament when you go looking for it, which I just didn't do for a lot of years. So, let's come on back to this again. Verse 15. Yet on your fathers did Yahweh set his affection to love them. And he chose their descendants after them, even you above all peoples, as it is this day. Circumcise then your heart, and stiffen your neck no more. For Yahweh your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who does not show partiality nor take a bribe. And again, brethren, in marriage covenants, and you're making a legislative decision about a covenant, you got to treat both parties the same. You don't say, I'm going to favor the guy that wants to break it and make the wife pay the price because she's going to get divorced. Just don't think so. In 18, he executes justice for the orphan and the widow. Now see, we didn't have to do that until James. We all know pure and undefiled religion, thanks to James, chapter 1, verse 26, was born in the New Testament. Prior to that, the old law was just about forms and about works and about ceremonies, and it didn't legislate about the heart. So pure and undefiled religion, as we know it in Christianity, is something new. Until you look at verse 18 in Deuteronomy. And what do you find? Pure and undefiled religion in the Old Testament. He executes justice for the orphan and the widow. Shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. So show your love for the alien. For you were aliens in the land of Egypt. You shall fear Yahweh your God. You shall serve him and cling to him. You shall swear by his name. He is your praise. He is your God who has done these great and awesome things for you, which your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons, and now Yahweh your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. You shall therefore love the Lord your God and always keep his charge, his statutes, his ordinances, and his commandments. Now, that's where I've chosen to stop this. What does Yahweh require? Only because, starting in verse 2, and know this day that... He does change the subject a little bit. Now, all he does is take another breath. It's the same event. There hasn't been any break whatsoever. Same people, same ideas. He's built his platform here. Here's what Yahweh requires. Remember what happened to Aaron. Know what's going to happen to me. I've already told you in preceding chapters. So, it's not because you're, you know, so many. It's not because you're righteous. It's not because you're prettier. And it's not because you're smarter. I'm adding the other two, you know. But it's not anything that you do. It's because there's a God of love who is love, who does love, and he's asking you to love. He wants you guys in this circumstance, you know, in Deuteronomy, to practice pure and undefiled religion. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. Now, let's turn to verse 2, and we'll read on down through 32. I've got about 10 minutes. I was hoping to finish the 11th chapter today, so that's not too big a rush, I don't think. So chapter 11, verse 2 now. I think what he does here is turn kind of from the glory and the majesty of God, if you will. What does Yahweh require? And it's wondrous and good things that he asks. Now, though, he wants to really bring it home to every individual soul that is standing there listening to Moses' appeal at this time. So watch how he does this now in verse 2. Know this day, I am not speaking with your sons who have not known and who have not seen the discipline of Yahweh your God, his greatness, his mighty hand, and his outstretched arm, and his signs and his works which he did in the midst of Egypt to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all his land, what he did to Egypt's army, to its horses and its chariots, when he made the water of the Red Sea to engulf them while they were pursuing you. And Yahweh completely destroyed them. And what he did to you in the wilderness until you came to this place. And what he did to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, sons of Reuben, when the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them, their households, their tents, and every living thing that follows them among all Israel. But your own eyes have seen all the great work of Yahweh which he did. So it took a long time to get there, but he started off in verse 2 by saying, I'm not talking to your sons, I'm talking to you. Your sons were born in the wilderness. They didn't see all these things, but you did. So now in 8, you shall therefore keep the commandment, which I'm commanding you today, so that you may be strong. It's in your best interest. And go in and possess the land it's in your best interest, to which you are about to cross to possess it, so that you may prolong your days on the land which the Lord swore to give your fathers, to give them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. It's all in your best interest. 10. For the land into which you are entering to possess it is not like the land of Egypt from which you came, where you used to sow your seed and water it with your foot like a vegetable garden. The land into which you're about to cross to possess is a land of hills and valleys, drinks water from the rain of heaven, a land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of Yahweh your God are always on it, from the beginning even to the end of the year. It shall come about, if you listen obediently to my commandments, which I'm commanding you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul. He will give the rain for your land in its season, the early and the late rain, that you may gather in your grain and your new wine and your oil. He'll give grass in your fields for your cattle. You shall eat and be satisfied. Beware lest your hearts be deceived and you turn away and serve other gods and worship them, or the anger of Yahweh will be kindled against you. He'll shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain. The ground will not yield its fruit. You'll perish quickly from the good land which Yahweh is giving you. You shall therefore impress these words of mine on your heart and on your soul. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall teach them to your sons, talking of them when you sit in your house, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you rise up. That's exactly what he told them only five chapters ago, chapter 6. Verse 20, you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, so that your days and the days of your sons may be multiplied on the land which Yahweh swore to your fathers to give them, as long as the heavens remain above the earth. For if you are careful to keep all this commandment which I'm commanding you, to do it, to love your God, to walk in all his ways and hold fast to him, then Yahweh will drive out all these nations from before you. You'll dispossess nations greater and mightier than you. Every place on which the sole of your foot shall tread shall be yours. Your border shall be from the wilderness to Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, as far as the western sea. So what's he saying? From Sinai in the south to Lebanon in the north, from the Euphrates in the far east, as it flows today, in to the Mediterranean. 25. There shall no man be able to stand before you. Yahweh your God shall lay the dread of you and the fear of you on all the land on which you set your foot, as he has spoken to you. See, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. Now, this is going to have great significance much later in the book. Whole chapters, starting with chapter 28, will elaborate upon the blessings and the curses, Ebal and Gerizim. So, we'll come back to that in much more detail. But this was on God's mind already. I'm setting before you today a blessing and a curse. 27. The blessing. If you listen to the commandments of Yahweh your God, which I'm commanding you today, and the curse, if you do not listen to the commandments of Yahweh your God, but turn aside from the way which I'm commanding you today by following other gods which you've not known, shall come about when Yahweh your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it. You shall place the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Are they not across the Jordan, west of the way toward the sunset, in the land of the Canaanites who live in the Arabah, opposite Gilgal, beside the oaks of Morah? Well, how many of them have been there? Not a one. Not the generation before or the generation before that for 400 years. They've never been there. They're going to get there. It's another prophecy. Are they not? We don't know. You'll find out soon enough. 31. For you are about to cross the Jordan, to go in to possess the land which Yahweh your God is giving you. You shall possess it and live in it. You shall be careful to do all the statutes and the judgments which I am setting before you today. That's why I want to get through chapter 11 here this morning. Starting with chapter 12 now, particularly, I'm going to try to pick up the pace and go a little bit faster, because we're going to see a whole lot of identical repetition to Leviticus. So, here's the commandments. But what we've seen tonight is this passionate, personal appeal from Moses upon the death of his brother. A few months later, here we are. He is appealing to these people to become like their God, to love their God with all their heart, with all their soul, to love widows and orphans. So practice pure and undefiled religion. You are to be the people that Yahweh and His laws create. The people that God wanted Adam and Eve to be. The people He wanted Cain and Abel to be, and only one of them was. The people He's wanted everybody to be before Abraham was ever born. Those people, from Abraham to Moses and from Moses to Jesus, who are called Jews, are just a very small group. Numerous as the sea, I understand, started with 70. I mean, it's a big number in one sense, but compared to the rest of the world, they're just the drop in the bucket. Tiny little group of people in a very small land. But those people, while they had dietary laws that would be done away, they had sacrificial laws that would be done away, they had a temple that would be done away, they did have a lot of physical stuff that God was going to do away. Long before that, and throughout it all, God was trying to create the heart that Jesus was when He came to this earth. That's what we're striving to be. Because He was in the flesh what God taught these people to be. Before Moses, during Moses, after Moses. Brethren, it's personal. It's between you and your God. Between His heart and yours. To be like He is. A people whose overarching primary quality is love. For God is love. Love Him with your whole heart and your whole soul. And love your brother as yourself. That is the greatest and foremost commandment. And it is unchanged before, during, or after Moses. It's between you and your God. Final words. No, wait, I've got 10 more minutes. Between you and your God, who will judge everybody impartially. Be ready. Class is over.